Ja, vielen Dank, Itay, für deinen Vortrag. Eine dichte Ausführung und eine sehr anschauliche Art, Kubla anzuwenden. Also das ist sehr anschaulich, das ist auch sprachlich brillant. Und ich habe die ganze Zeit nach einem Wort gesucht, ein deutsches Wort, um dich zu bezeichnen. En français, c'est crapuleux, ce que tu fais. Oui, ein Wort mit S, ich glaube. Also, nein, Itay, das ist nicht negativ. Also, ich meine damit, dass du Kubla in dich aufnimmst und etwas mit ihnen machst, aber eigentlich, indem du Kubla mit Lorrain zu denken versuchst, bringst du Kubla in mehrfacher Hinsicht zu seinen Grenzen auch. Und das nicht ohne Genuss an der Paradoxie, finde ich. Also, und das möchte ich jetzt versuchen zu entfalten. Der erste Punkt ist zunächst, sind die Objekte, mit denen du das machst, und das sind extreme Objekte, und zwar nicht unbedingt die, an denen Kubla erstmal denkst. Das sind diese sehr merkwürdigen französischen Objekte, die so tun, als ob sie nicht Objekte, nicht Dinge wären, sondern nur Bilder. Also machen sich möglichst flach, machen sich vergessen, geben sich als reine Form. Und natürlich ist das etwas, was die europäische Kunstgeschichte sehr geprägt hat und Kubla auch. Und indem er versucht, an etwas anderes zu denken, denkt er natürlich noch sehr an diese Objekte, die sich als reine Bilder, reine Formen geben. Und wie du auch dann am Ende erinnert hast, viel versatiler sind, sich viel schneller ändern als funktionalere Dinge. Also dafür ist es ein extremer Fall, und Kubla eben da anzuwenden, das ist nicht ganz ohne Witz. So, das stimmst du zu. Okay. Die zweite Punkt ist deine Wiedereinführung der Biografie, wo Kubla dabei anfängt, das auf der Seite zu führen. Bringst du die Biografie wieder ein, indem du nach dem Kublerian Artist fragst und eben versuchst, Kubla an seiner eigenen Falle zu fangen und Kubla als künstlerisches Problem zu stellen, was Lorrain beantworten würde, ne? Also Kubla als Formproblem und die Lösung von Claude Lorrain. Die dritte Sache ist die Wiedereinführung der Ikonografie, weil du versuchst eben, Kubla ikonografisch zu denken. Und das finde ich interessant, eben mit Giordano Bruno, der eben für Panofsky eine große Rolle spielt, in der Perspektive als symbolische Form, weil Panofsky behauptet ja oder versucht ja, diese Erfindung der Unendlichkeit für die gotische Architektur zu nutzen. Und zwar ist es ein bisschen weit davon, aber du konzeptualisierst das besser. Es liegt ja nahe, das mit Claude Lorrain zu tun. Also insofern kannst du auch eine kublerianische Ikonografie-Methode da entwickeln, die die Frage von Panofsky eben verkomplexifiert und kontextualisiert. Auch. Also, die Objekte, die Biografie, die Ikonografie. Und was dabei bleibt, ist, was machen wir jetzt mit deinem Versuch der Anwendung? Wir versuchen ja hier zu überlegen, was eine Anwendung von Kubla sein könnte. Man kann ja anwenden in sich, für sich, ob dir das hilft für dein Projekt über Lorrain. Oder ist das mehr ein Denkanstoß, ein Anwendungsversuch, nicht wegen der Anwendung für sich, sondern einfach um weiterzudenken. Also wenn, vielleicht kann man Kubla nicht anwenden, aber ist der Versuch der Anwendung etwas wert, da an der Methode weiterzudenken? Und die Frage wäre, wer formuliert denn das Problem, das künstlerische Problem? Weil auch du kannst über einen Korpus verfügen, eigentlich eine ideale Abfolge von Bildern von Claude Lorrain, die oft genau datiert sind, dann kannst du auf diesem Feld einfach kommen. Das ist eigentlich ein idealer Zugang. So funktionieren ja Objekte nicht, wenn sie nicht sich in dem Musée imaginaire abgebildet sind, ne, um das so wieder zu nennen. Also Kubla sagt ja, es gibt Probleme und deshalb suchen wir nach Problemen in dem Fall. Und es ist der Versuch, ein Problem zu rekonstruieren. Und so benutzt du auch Giordano Bruno in diesem Fall. Also, aber wie werden Probleme geboren und wie werden auch Lösungen, wie entstehen sie? Da wäre die Frage, wie man als Historiker mit dieser Frage umgeht. Stellt man a posteriori Probleme oder versucht man sie zu rekonstruieren? Was hat denn die Menschen betrieben? Und es gibt bei Kubla einen gewissen Fortschrittsglauben oder evolutionäres Modell. Und da wäre die, was ist denn der Status dieser Erzählung, die man dann entwickelt? Also Haupterzählung, so einen Hauptstrang zu einer Linie dazu zu ziehen. Was ist das wert und der Status davon neben der ganzen Komplexheit der Sachen? Also da würde ich mich fragen, also eben über den unseren Umgang als Historiker mit Problemen. So, also soweit zu meinem Versuch der Entfaltung deines Versuches und deines Angebots. Und damit möchte ich jetzt auch die Diskussion eröffnen und bitte um Meldung. Sarah? Du möchtest, Entschuldigung, Entschuldigung.
Well, I don't have much to say, just maybe a confession, because you said my choice of object was not obvious for Kubler, and I said it in the beginning of my paper, but it's obviously the reason is that my choice of object was prior to my choice of Kubler. So I chose my object. I knew Kubler, but not very much so, and thanks to this conference, I reread Kubler, and I thought, well, it really works for Claude, and so if this conference did something, it's already to make people reconsider Kubler and use it for their objects, even if the objects are not particularly Kubler friendly, I would say. The other thing I wanted to say about iconography and Panofsky, well, you probably noticed that I didn't mention Panofsky. I did mention Damisch, that is kind of the I would say the French remaking of Panofsky's perspective theory, and Damisch, in fact, was also my when I started this project, was my kind of my pre-Kubler in a sense, because he also does in his The Origin of Perspective, he analyzes a series of the theories of three Urbino ideal cities, and he analyzes I don't know if he mentions Kubler, I'm not sure he does, I'm not sure he knew Kubler, but he does a slightly similar thing in analyzing a series of three paintings and how they all transform the same traits, they take them and transform them from one another. So Kubler theorizes it, and Damisch does it also in The Origin of Perspective, and I thought I would do what I would try to do to Claude what Damisch proposed, but then I found Kubler that does it in an even more spectacular way, as it were. So but so Panofsky, I don't know, I'm a bit skeptical, but why not?
Sarah?
Yes, thank you for this wonderful application, which I think also shows a lot of the problems Kubler model poses, and I was just wondering if what you make is really an application of Kubler, because I think you left out something. I think it's crucial or elementary of the the concept, it's the systematic age, and you didn't talk about it because if I don't know the paintings of Lorrain, so I don't know if you really went forward chronologically with the paintings, but I think I understand it. And so the question is it really a chronological, theological evolution within Lorrain's oeuvre, which leads to a final best solution, like a prime object at the end, or emulatio of everything before, because it's a double a final solution? You said it's within the sequence of Lorrain, and also within the sequence of Lorrain with other artists. And I was just wondering, is this really Kubler's thinking? Because I think Kubler would just resolve it. And at the last, this last image was that is a copy of an earlier image. This is systematic age. I mean, it's an earlier solution has been proposed, and it was before a later solution was there. So I mean, the time, the chronological time is dissolved in the concept of Kubler. And I was just wondering if you thought about to applicate this systematic age within the oeuvre of Lorrain to think, say, okay, maybe this solution is later in time, but earlier in or later in in the sequence.
I didn't mention the word systematic age, but I did mention at some point that this idea of Kubler that everything goes in an early, mature, and late style. And I probably should have used this term because I finished with this problem of this painting that seems to be the last. Yeah, the problem you just mentioned, the fact that this painting is both early and late, and maybe the Kubler's theory of systematic age can help me formulate it better. What I just did is saying, well, it makes the theory more complex and more problematic, but maybe Kubler did solve this problem already and I didn't notice. So,
thank you for this absolutely lovely talk. I enjoyed it, and I also enjoyed looking at the images. They were lovely to look at. Question about the problem. I think it's a very nicely stated, the problem of the infinite and the man-made, the sea and the architecture, the sun and the sea and the architecture. And you're posing the problem of, do we identify a problem or do we try to reconstruct the problems that they were identifying, the artist himself was identifying or dealing with? It makes me wonder, you asked me yesterday the difference between a motif and a morphome, going back to that. The motif might be the infinite and the man-made in port scenes repeating. Morphome would be the idea behind it, the problem, the knowledge about the relationship between man and the sea, or architecture in the sea. And I wonder, is there literature? What is the context, the cultural context in the 1630s? Or, you know much more about this period. Are there operas or texts or literature that come up with terms for what the sea is or what this relationship is that he is working out visually, knowledge about? I mean, yes, it's the transition of the humanism that appears at this time. But.
Thanks. I will ignore the whole morphome question because I wasn't here the first day and I'm still struggling with this term, so I'll try to do better next time. But as to your question of the cultural references, well, it's a problematic term. It's a problematic question with Claude because it's not part of those so-called intellectual artists that were known to be friends with all the authors of the time and the philosophers like his contemporary Poussin. Claude is, we don't know anything about his intellectual life, if he had any, probably wasn't what we would call today an intellectual. So in this sense, we can only guess at what he just felt around him. And now, the two references I did give and that are slightly related to Claude, one is Pascal that I mentioned about infinity, and in this case, Pascal is writing more or less at the same time of Claude's mature paintings. He's writing, of course, in France, and Claude was by then in Rome for forever, but he had contacts with Paris and Parisian clients. And anyway, the fact that not maybe not Pascal's proper philosophical ideas, but the fact that he took the existence of infinity as a given is important in this sense, because as I said, Giordano Bruno was burned more or less for that 40 years later earlier, and then comes Pascal, who is a very pious man and is very worried about infinity. So it's very interesting, and in this sense, by the 1640s, infinity was really a almost trivialized theme. While the sea, I mentioned Alain Corbin, who's a historian that wrote a book about the attraction that we have today for the sea and its origins, and he places it later. He places it the beginning of it around 1740. So, which he has a long introduction in which he claims that in the 17th century, the sea was actually a repulsive and a frightening place more than anything else, and represented anything bad you can think of: diseases, pirates, whatever danger was the sea. So in this sense, and there is an anecdote in one of Claude's very slim and short biographies. There is an anecdote that tells us that when he went from France to Rome for the first time, I think he took the boat, and he was terribly, he was almost died in a sea storm. So we can, of course, We shouldn't do too much out of that, but we can also say, well, Claude knew the dangers of the sea and was probably happy to stay in the port and to look at the sea, but to not go there. But of course, it's biographical anecdote, and then I don't want to go too much into biography because Kubler will be in my back.
Kerstin?
You know, I really enjoyed this lecture. In thinking about this later work, which duplicates the earlier work, I started to think of the problem given by Borges in rewriting Don Quixote in a latish century, and how much harder the task is because you have to write it word for word, the same as it was when it was first written, but everything else has passed in the meantime. And this artist is faced with the same thing, that it must have occurred to him that he somehow had a solution that was wonderful early on and didn't somehow recognize it. And so he brings it up again, he reproduces it, and it would be interesting to know whether he does this from his mind or in front of this earlier work. Do we know that?
No.
It would be fascinating to know.
Thank you for the. Well, Borges is one of my favorite authors, so the Pierre Ménard references, I didn't think of it in this context, but of course it would be very interesting. Although here it's the same person, and there it's a different person, so it's slightly different. But no, we don't. I mean, I don't think we know much about. We don't even know if someone asked it for it in particular for him to make the same copy, to copy the same work, which is also a possibility. But it would be a shame because it makes the whole thing much less interesting. But we just don't know much about this specific command.
No, I thank you too for the lecture. I was thinking not in Kublerian terms, but just art historical terms, about whether or not actually the architectural literature on port construction might be useful. I know the academic competitions from the Accademia di San Luca in the very early 18th century, you know, where interestingly the conceptualization of these big port plans that they did was that the port is the safe harbor, the point of arrival. And I keep looking at these, and the interesting thing is that it's not about either the safe arrival, nor is it setting out to the sea. I mean, they're actually very, you know, ambiguous in terms of it's a meeting point, I think, as you say, but it's neither one nor the other. It's not here is the place you leave the safe harbor, or that you arrive in the safe harbor, which is, I don't know if that becomes the morphem. Or
why did you choose not to show the copy, I mean, that the original that this is a copy of, do you not have it, or is it so exactly the same?
It's almost exactly the same. I just didn't think of it. But yeah, I mean, sorry, just didn't occur to me.
Is it?
I must say, I haven't seen these particular paintings. I haven't seen okay. any of the two. I've seen all the others, but not these two.
Yeah,
I didn't. I want to go to Munich to see it, but didn't. So I can't tell you if they really feel differently. Okay. It also, of course, unless an exhibition is organized in which there will be one near the other, it will be quite impossible to really compare them. But as far as the literature goes, they're supposed to be almost identical.
Thomas Ruiz and
there.
The discussion both of performance and media arts and this discussion of certainly the kind of representational, the stoffage of a piece like this also makes me think that we have so often been thinking of Kubler with the model of, let's say, the Gothic cathedral, the kind of machine of parts that get added together as, you know, very, very kind of technical problems that allow you to advance. But I keep thinking here, you know, could we say that the strands of the form class are, to get away from purely formal painting problems, you know, the representation of the foreground problem, right? You know, how you enter the piece, the infinity problem. Where is the point of resolution? Is the architectural representations a form class? Is the actual figures shown and what their actions are a form class? And that ultimately each of these in any one painting is a form class that is working their way as they change towards, you know, the ultimate painting. In the same way as the in the media arts, you know, do we consider the cutting of the film as a problem, the videoing of that as a problem, the nature of the performance as a form problem, so that ultimately, you know, the solution, the problem, is actually to participate in a genre, which is the representation of which is playing the rules of that genre within the art world, and that each one of those are form classes with different systematic ages and different forms of evolution, and that ultimately you don't have to worry about what the end product is, right? The end product doesn't have to be, what the cut time you pick is not so important as the flows working. So it just makes me think about trying to extend Kubler and ask whether he would accept those things
but
or not.
This would be a problem in art historical terms, because we tend to think of works of art as a whole and as a very holistic entity. We don't want to divide into fragments, but maybe from a Kublerian point of view, it would work.
Certainly his idea of the cut through the rope with strands was that there were these separate problems that in any one work of art were different points of resolution.
Ja, bitte. Hier ganz hinten ist eine Frage.
Ich schließe mich auch dem Dank für den Vortrag an, den ich eindrucksvoll und einleuchtend gleichermaßen fand. Meine Frage richtet, oder schließt sich aber dann auch wieder an die Frage, die Philippe Cordet gestellt hat, oder auch das Problem, was Thomas Rees gerade angesprochen hat, wie kontingent ist eigentlich die Strukturierung dieser Sequenz? Also ich, die ganze Zeit, während ich auf dieses Bild schaue, fallen mir Sequenzen ein, in denen es sozusagen einen Ort einnehmen kann. Das kann also die Sequenz natürlich der Gestaltung des Unendlichen sein. Das kann das Problem sein, wie male ich die Takelage eines Schiffes? Und dort kann dieses Bild ganz unterschiedliche systematische Altersstufen einnehmen. Das heißt also, wie frei ist der Interpret, sozusagen die Sequenz zu bestimmen, den Anfang, die Positionen, das Ende.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you for this question. Obviously, the art historian is free to build the sequence as he likes, and it is necessarily arbitrary, as I said. I think the order of the sequence itself was chronological, as I said. The starting point and the end point are obviously contingent. Yeah, I mean, I did choose the kind of the last, very last years of Claude's life as the end point. So in this sense, it was an obvious choice. But the beginning, as I said, was quite arbitrary. But then again, that's what we do. I think we try to build a narrative out of the data, and it is. I mean, there could be any other. I mean, there can be very interesting other formal sequences offered to Claude, and I will probably take them, accept them as well. I mean, this is what I think is important in this painting. I don't know if I answered.
Yes, I would agree with that. Kubler says in the beginning of his book, Shape of Time, the job of the art historian, a historian, is to identify patterns in history for the first time, to see them for the first time, maybe that others have not seen, and to narrate that history, right? So I think we can pick any point in a sequence. The challenge is to identify the sequence, right? My other thought was the problems, as Thomas Rees was saying, the problems of the different parts of the painting and how to integrate them, or that not only how to integrate them, but working out the problems of each of those separate parts, places him in a long tradition of port-making scenes. And I like that you began before him and extended. See, there's different levels of sequences or extensions of the sequence. And I think Kubler would be interested, obviously, in the larger sequence, not just Lorraine, but what is the art historical problem that existed before Lorraine came along that he's struggling with and that continues on beyond him. Mm. I think that's what Kubler would find probably interesting. Yeah. In this.
And I think if the problem is taken in a very general sense, as for example, of the contiguous representation of something that is infinite or something that is very delimited, then we can go on till at least the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, it's almost illimited. And maybe it's still going on, or we'll come back to this scene.
I just thought about how our problem would have changed if we wouldn't have looked at the history of a motif, but at a series of paintings of the same building or exactly the same harbor.
These are not real harbors. So.
Yes, I know. But how would our problem have changed if we would have done this? If we would have taken one special building or one special harbor and would have looked at the development through the time.
You mean a real existing harbor?
Yes.
But this would not concern Claude, because he painted only one or two real harbors. I mean, these harbors are just mixtures of imaginary buildings that are, some of them are based on existing buildings, for example, the one with Villa Medici, but they're modified, they put together with buildings that have nothing to do with them. So it's very hard. If we take reality as a starting point, I think we'll be losing our way very quickly.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
The what, sorry?
That was the question. It was not your case study with Claude, but the whole problem to think how to practice art history when we would have a real.
Es gibt ja auch Serien von Malern, die dasselbe Gebäude in Abständen wieder gemalt haben. Und da stellen sich dann ja ganz andere Probleme, als wenn man von einem Motiv, also dem Hafen als abstraktes Motiv ausgeht. Das war meine Frage.
Okay, yeah, of course, there is a Monet painting the Cathedral of Rouen, and then he's always taking the same building. And what I would have to say about the method of art history and the practice of art history, that I would always start from the case. So in my case, it's very interesting proposals, but because I started with the corpus of paintings and then looked for the theoretical framework in which I could place them, I had to choose a theoretical framework that can work with these paintings. So I mean.
Also in dem Fall von Monet wäre das eine explizite Sequenz, weil es ist ja so konzipiert. Das Problem ist vom Maler auch selbst explizit gestellt. In der Tat, das ist anders. Sarah?
Yes, I want to come back to your your answer. And I think the question, the main question is, what do you want to achieve with the application of the sequence? I mean, you can just say, oh, I want to construct a sequence, and then the single object is, yeah, you have to reduce it necessarily. You can't see every aspect of it. Or you want to apply the sequence on one object, and then you look what there are different sequences in this object. And that's what you said, Formklassen. So Formklasses, to look, are there different sequences in one object? And it's two different, these are two different approaches which can't be put together, I think, in one work.
I think they could, but I mean, but my idea would be to try to do both, to take the whole sequence, because it's a very, I mean, it's a natural sequence, as it were. It's not something that I invented. It are port scenes by Claude Lorrain. I mean, it's not, it's quite easy to define. And then again, so I do, my final product will be a work on the whole sequence, but then again, it will include help. What I didn't do here, in most of my presentations, I take one painting and I concentrate on it most of the time. But because I wanted to talk about formal sequences, I did that. But I think the two things can be done together, I hope.
But these are two different applications then. It's not one application, but you apply the sequence on two different perspectives, I think. That's what I...
Maybe.
Victoria Schmidt-Linsenhof.
Ich wollte nochmal auf die Frage zurückkommen, wer das Problem stellt, wer das Problem formuliert. War das jetzt Agostino Tassi, dann hat es Brill modifiziert und in ihrer Darstellung Lorrain sozusagen die beste Lösung oder die komplexeste Lösung gefunden. Und das ist, es gibt ja auch die Instanz, die Institution des Marktes, es gibt eine Nachfrage und es gibt die Nachfrage nach bestimmten Themen, also die, man könnte sagen, die Öffnung der Welt, der alten Welt, die Expansion, das ist sozusagen ein Thema, was ein zeitgenössisches Thema, was ein Problem stellt, oder bei Caravaggio, dass es bestimmte Bildtypen gibt, die er prägt und die dann unendlich oft kopiert und zirkulieren auf dem Markt, weil es eine starke Nachfrage nach diesen Themen gibt, für die so ein eigentlich ein Bildtypus entwickelt wird, der einen relativ großen Interpretationsspielraum bietet. Also wenn man das so formuliert, es ist ein Thema, es gibt eine Öffentlichkeit von Sammlern, Collectern, also den Käufern, die das haben wollen, es gibt einen Markt, der das vermittelt und es gibt Künstler, die sich darauf einlassen. Und diese ganze Seite der Rezeption, die fehlt ja bei Kubler. Also ich komme jetzt einfach auf das, dass man sich nicht in der Anwendung zu stark da in so einer Zwangsjacke begibt, die so eine wichtige Instanz wie im 17. Jahrhundert der Markt in Rom, der auch ganz gut erforscht ist, also die Nachfrageseite, den Wunsch, solche Bilder zu haben, von der Öffnung der Welt und die Idealisierung auch, dass die Expansion was quasi Sakrales wird, also wie es dann interpretiert wird. Also meine Frage nochmal, wer stellt das Problem sozusagen.
I mean, this is definitely an aspect I didn't work on much, and I think maybe in this case this would be two things that can be hardly combined, to work on the reception and the market and how come these paintings were wished for by acquirers and to assume that there is an artistic personality that develops out of its own. Out of his own evolution. I agree that it's a very important aspect, but I did make the choice of basically ignoring it. And in the case of Claude, again, it's quite easy because he did work for the market, as it were. But we don't have much information about the commissions and about, so the art historian is quite free to. To imagine, in this sense. And again, I think if we work from, you can work from a very historical point of view, but you can also work from a point of view that takes into account the importance of these paintings. Why is it important to work on these paintings today? And beyond the historical facts of their being painted in the 17th century, and why am I interested today in the 21st century in this formal sequence? And I think it's because it poses very complex theoretical questions. So in this sense, the fact that there was a market or there wasn't a market for them is a different question that for me it just is less interesting.
Ich wollte nicht abheben auf so eine soziologische oder kunstsoziologische Erklärung, sondern den Anteil des Betrachters, also die, den produktiven, kreativen Anteil an künstlerischen Erfindungen, dass da